This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Michael Ratner reports from Fort Meade, Maryland, on the sentencing in the Bradley Manning trial.
The man's a hero, not a traitor. He did no harm except to those people who committed crimes in the military that he exposed.
We'll talk about journalist Barrett Brown, who spent more than 330 days in pretrial detention and faces up to 105 years in prison.
A young man, a great journalist, made the mistake with one keystroke of sending some files from one place to another, and now they want to really throw the book at him.
We'll learn how Native Hawaiian prisoners are being transferred to a private prison facility in Arizona.
What worse can you do to a Native Hawaiian than taking him from his roots in his home and sending him to, of all places, Arizona?
Protesters continue a noontime sing-along in Wisconsin's capital.
They rewrote the words to the old songs. We speak to a guy that goes down there and sings and puts on his other hat and represents him. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Ratner, it's good to be able to speak with you. You're down at Fort Meade. The sentence was just meted out to Bradley Manning. They gave him 35 years. Why such a draconian sentence? What did he do, and why did they punish him like that?
You know, I'm here at Fort Meade. We have a lot of press. A courtroom was filled. The judge came out and didn't even have to give individual sentences in the sense of charge by charge. She just gave him a 35-year sentence. And, you know, some people are saying, well, the sentence wasn't so long because he was facing 136 years, and then he was facing 90. But that's outrageous. 35 years is a completely off-the-wall sentence. First of all, he shouldn't have been prosecuted at all. That's been the Center for Constitutional Rights position. It's my position. He's a whistleblower. He exposed torture, criminality, killing of civilians. He should not have been prosecuted at all. And then what happens is they over-prosecute him. To the extent they did it, they charge him with espionage. They make whistleblowers into spies. They charge him with all these years. And then people are relieved when he gets 35 years. Let me tell you, that's no relief. He's 25 years old. Assuming he were to get the best credit he could, he's going to do at least a minimum of 20-some more years. It's a very long sentence. For someone who actually gave us the truth about Iraq, about Iran, about the helicopter video that killed the Reuters journalist, about the diplomatic cables that gave us the secret war in Yemen, the revelations about the Ben Ali corrupt government in Tunisia that helped bring on Arab Spring. He's a hero. The people who committed the crime, sadly, are still in our government, are enjoying their lives. They're the ones that ought to be prosecuted. And I don't want it heard that he, Bradley Manning, should have been prosecuted at all, but particularly, of course, while these criminals are out there with complete immunity.
How was the trial set up to get this result?
Well, they first overcharged him with six espionage counts and plus an aiding the enemy count. It was a judge trial. It's a military trial, so it's under the military jurisdiction. It's at Fort Meade, a few, you know, very close to the National Security Agency. So you can imagine how they think about someone who is spilling their dirty secrets and their criminality. They don't think highly. It's a very severe sentence. You know, the center is actually in the past, but Bill Kunstler has as well with us, represented people who actually either sold their secrets to either the Soviet Union or others, and those people didn't receive a severe sentence. We're in really a time in which you could say there's a sledgehammer being taken to whistleblowers, and it's just, I find it just unbelievable to me that someone whose information we need so badly in an utterly secret government is being sentenced or has been sentenced to 35 years in prison.
What role did Obama play in this, and what demands can we make to get him out?
Well, Obama's the commander-in-chief, so ultimately he controls it. Obama's role was not good. He actually influenced the trial, in my view, although I think they probably would have convicted him in any case. But he's the one who said basically that he's guilty. That's command influence. He shouldn't have been tried after that. The demand now is that Obama pardon him, give him clemency, pardon or clemency. That's a demand of the Bradley Manning Support Committee, and it should be all of our demands.
Daniel Ellsberg had his case dismissed. And that was a time when there was a massive anti-war movement in the streets. Would you say that because we lack that now, they were able to bludgeon Manning?
You know, I think that there's a growing movement, particularly after Snowden. But there's no question that having a huge movement like we had during the Ellsberg case is what got ultimately Ellsberg out of that espionage charge. There's a growing movement in this country as more and more comes out. Let's just remember what a leader Bradley Manning is. Because of Bradley Manning, I think that people like Ed Snowden came forward. They understood that when they see criminality, they're young people of conscience, and they act on it. And we should be very proud of each of these people.
Michael, you got to run. You're at Fort Meade. Everybody wants to hear from you. You got any last thoughts before you take off?
My last thoughts are we're in one of the nastiest administrations probably on record. It's going after the truth tellers. We have to support Bradley Manning. We have to support Ed Snowden, Julian Assange, Jeremy Hammond, Barrett Brown, and the others out there. And this is only part of their criminality. Exposing their criminality is what this is about, and they don't want that.
Thank you, Michael Ratner from Fort Meade. We'll speak with you again next week.
So long, guys. Bye-bye.
Heidi Boghossian, before we interview Kevin Gallagher about the prosecution and persecution of Barrett Brown, I wanted to ask you, because this is something that you write about in your just published book, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Well, your book really encompasses what happened to Barrett Brown, because he fell into the clutches of that kind of unholy alliance between the private intelligence corporations, the government corporations, the Department of Justice, and now the guy's looking at 105 years in prison for essentially posting something on a chat room. Give us the context of what you write about in your book about this.
Well, Michael, I'll actually read you a couple of paragraphs because it leads right into our next interview. In talking, I have a chapter titled A Whopper, A Coke, An Order of Spies, that basically lays out how public awareness of and opposition to corporate malfeasance threatens both the profits of carefully manufactured family-friendly images of multinational companies such as Burger King or Coca-Cola, and how these food and beverage giants, so fearful of citizens engaging in boycotts or educational campaigns, increasingly turn to surveillance of individuals and infiltration of organizations working to reveal offensive and often criminal business practices. But let me just read you a couple of paragraphs related to the subject at hand. In early 2011, the loosely associated network of hacktivists known as Anonymous provided a glimpse into how private contractors engage in what came to be known as, quote, dirty tricks after the Nixon-era Watergate break-ins. Anonymous hacked into and released tens of thousands of emails of technology security company HP Gary Federal, which engages in classified work for the federal government, along with its sister company HP Gary. The emails revealed alleged plans to engage in unlawful tactics to embarrass corporate critics, such as launching cyber attacks and campaigns of disinformation, creating false social networking profiles, phishing emails, and intimidating donors to nonprofit groups and unions critical of its clients. Among the clients was the law firm Hunton and Williams, which represented Bank of America and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Targeted people and organizations included Glenn Greenwald, the U.S. Chamber Watch, Change to Win, WikiLeaks, and the Center for American Progress. H.P. Gary also proposed to Hunton and Williams that it work with Palantir Technologies and Berico Technologies to attack WikiLeaks, which was rumored to be preparing to release Bank of America emails. The firms planned to use malicious and intrusive software to steal private information. They also planned to disrupt internal group communication using social network sites and other social engineering tactics, basically counterterrorism techniques originally developed to combat violent organizations. That's a snippet of some of the things that these private contractors are doing and the partners they're doing them with, including the U.S. government.
And it was Barrett Brown's bad luck to fall into their embrace. Not only Barrett Brown, but his mother.
Exactly. journalist Barrett Brown has spent more than 330 days in pretrial detention in Texas, facing up to 105 years in prison. What was his crime? He copied a link from a chat room and pasted it to another for a wiki-based crowdsource group called Project PM. Emails contained therein included encrypted credit card numbers and validation codes. But why go after Barrett Brown with such vengeance? He uncovered an elaborate relationship between a large Washington, D.C. law firm and a private intelligence firm, and their plans to discredit and destroy anti-corporate critics, including mainstream journalists. We're joined today by activist Kevin Gallagher, who started the website Free Barrett Brown almost immediately after Barrett was arrested. Welcome, Kevin, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, we'd like to start by asking you to give a brief overview for our listeners. Who is Barrett Brown? Many people haven't heard of him, although his case is extremely significant.
Barrett Brown is an investigative journalist and freelance writer who has had a career writing for Huffington Post, The Guardian, True Slant, and many other places. Through his observing the media landscape over the last 10 years in America, I think he grew very dissatisfied with the current state of things. So when this phenomenon called Anonymous popped up in 2010, making major news headlines, he kind of attached himself to it, and that's where he gained notoriety.
And Barrett spoke a lot publicly about Anonymous. Do you think that attracted the attention of the authorities?
I think definitely. As soon as he was doing interviews talking about Anonymous, he would have been on the radar.
One of the things that he's been charged with is literally cutting and pasting a link from one site to another. For that, he faces many years in prison. Then there's some other charges, but we wanted to talk about the significance of this because there's been so much in the press recently about information freedom. Bradley Manning's sentencing just came down last week. We have Jeremy Hammond in New York, who is facing potentially 10 years in prison after he took a plea deal. What do you make of this crackdown on literally information that was already out there? All Barrett did was move it from one place to another.
It's really the most absurd thing, and it sets a really dangerous precedent. All he was doing was looking at this information that was leaked by Jeremy Hammond out of Stratfor as part of his journalistic inquiry into the world of private intelligence firms. And you know, the fact that they can indict someone on identity theft and credit card fraud just for sharing a link to information, you know, there's no allegation that he sought to profit from it. Because of the fact that it contained credit card numbers, now, you know, it's adding up to all these decades upon decades of time for him.
Barrett Brown had formed Project PM, which, if I'm not mistaken, was dealing with the great number of private corporations that conduct intelligence for the U.S. government. Is that what the information on Project PM was all about?
Yes. Project PM, like over its entire lifespan, was a number of different things, but that's what it eventually evolved into, was a crowdsourced research project with a wiki that was devoted solely to investigating the state corporate alliance on surveillance.
Can you talk a little bit about the information that came out in the WikiLeaks about the plans by a private security agency and a law firm in D.C. basically to discredit some journalists and critics of government and corporations? It sounded very much like a COINTELPRO sort of black ops, dirty tricks operation.
This was known as Team Themis. It was a consortium of these firms, including H.P. Gary, Palantir, and many others.
Tell us about this intricate relationship that was uncovered related to Bank of America and the law firm and intelligence firm. What happened?
And this all started when you know, WikiLeaks was said to have information from the Bank of America. Bank of America went to their law firm, Hunton & Williams, which is a very powerful and well-connected law firm in Washington, D.C. Consortium of these firms were doing work at the behest of the Chamber of Commerce and through their very well-connected firm, Hunton & Williams, plotting to attack mainstream journalists like Glenn Greenwald, people who defended WikiLeaks. They wanted to submit fake documents in order to sow discord and cause doubt in the platform. You know, this all started because Bank of America was worried that that WikiLeaks had information on them. And a number of things came out that, you know, there's potential criminality there. And Barrett was one of the people, along with Project PM, who really helped shed a light on this.
And were any of those entities ever brought to a court of law for what they were planning to do?
No. I mean, there were calls for investigation from a few members of Congress. But the Department of Justice never ever investigated this.
We're speaking with Kevin Gallagher, a writer and systems administrator up in Massachusetts, and he's been supporting Barrett Brown. Kevin, what's the link? Is it a revolving door between these private intelligence firms, the Department of Justice, the law firms / lobby firms? What's the link between these various outfits and Barrett Brown?
I would just say Barrett was investigating this. There are other journalists who do very good work on this, but he was one of the most vocal who was involved in investigating all these relationships between the private intel firms and the DOJ. He was using leaked emails to do so. I think they were very upset with seeing these things revealed because there is a revolving door between all these firms. The people that go to create the private intel firms, ex-CIA, ex-NSA, just back and forth, and they get tons of money in government contracts. There's no oversight from the public. So Barrett recognized that this was a threat, and he was looking into it.
Kevin, it wasn't only Barrett that was targeted. The authorities actually went after his mother. And what was that about?
This is really outrageous. The fact that the FBI agent in Barrett's case had threatened his mother with charges. This all happened in the wake of the FBI raid in March 2012 on Barrett's apartment and his mother's apartment. What they're saying is that she had helped him allegedly conceal some laptops that they were looking for, which had all his information, all his sources as a journalist on them. I think she's innocent, but nonetheless, they were able to extract a guilty plea on obstruction charges, and she's going to be sentenced later this year.
Yeah, she's looking at a year in prison, Heidi. You know, it reminded me of the comment that Glenn Greenwald made when the British authorities detained his partner at the airport in London. Greenwald said, you know, even the mafia had an unwritten rule that they wouldn't go after people's families. And here they're
right.
Doing that to Barrett.
And I understand Barrett came to her rescue, maybe said something to an FBI agent. They slapped some more charges on related to that.
Yeah, I mean Barrett was really frustrated over the whole investigation and the fact that they went over after his mother. So what he was arrested for was basically speaking out in a YouTube video and allegedly threatening the agent. But once they arrested him, they used that as an opportunity to indict him several more times.
You know, it's interesting because the Supreme Court has held for decades that rhetorical political speech, such as saying, you know, I want to kill the president, is protected free speech to a certain degree. It has to obviously be deemed a political outburst, and the context, of course, matters. But it seems to me that, and I haven't seen the YouTube piece, but Barrett does have a reputation for being, you know, I've heard he's very funny and has an acerbic wit.
How old is Barrett?
Barrett just turned 32 the other week on August 14th.
So if they give him the sentence they're looking, he'll be 137 years old when he gets out of prison. Where is he?
Yeah.
He's down in Texas in prison now?
He's at Mansfield Law Enforcement Center in Texas.
And is there a way for people to write him if they'd like to? Or
yes, they should go to freebarrettbrown.org. If you go to the contact page, we have his mailing address up there, and there's all the information on how to donate as well.
Free Barrett Brown, that's Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, freebarrettbrown.org.
Kevin, we really value the work that you're doing on behalf of Barrett. Thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to having you on for more updates, hopefully with a more positive spin.
What's the status of the case now? What's going to happen next legally?
Before the court right now is a motion for a media gag order, which is presented by the prosecution, which would silence Brown and his attorneys from making statements to the media. The court could rule on that any day now. It could be this week, could be next week. Barrett's trials will be in April and May of next year. There's two trials.
Kevin, it was an honor to have you on. We greatly appreciate the work that you're doing and look forward to having you on for more updates, hopefully with a positive spin.
Thanks so much, Kevin Gallagher. Free Barrett Brown. Hawaii sends more prisoners across state lines than any other state. According to the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation, a disproportionate number of these prisoners are Native Hawaiians. Because of overcrowding, Native Hawaiian inmates are transferred from Hawaii State Prison to a for-profit Corrections Corporation of America prison in Arizona. The Arizona prison was especially built for Native Hawaiians. There, they're denied their cultural and religious practices. Additional transfer impacts include difficulty reentry back into Hawaii, away from family and their homes, and no opportunity for being rehabilitated. We're joined today by attorney Sharla Manley with the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation for more details on the movement of Native Hawaiian inmates.
Sharla, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We wanted to ask you about your legal involvement in issues that affect Native Hawaiians, who are now Americans and not by choice. We particularly wanted to ask you about the policy of the state of Hawaii moving prisoners from Hawaii to Arizona. And I understand you've been involved in litigation around that issue. Can you tell us what's going on?
Sure. Happy to do that. We have been involved in a lawsuit for the past 2 years concerning the impact of Hawaii's policy of transferring inmates to the mainland on Native Hawaiians. And as you've explained very well, Native Hawaiians are the indigenous people of the state of Hawaii, and they have a similar experience to American Indians on the continent. And what our law firm does is we focus on Native Hawaiian rights and what we see as the self-determination that remains despite the history. And one of the arenas that we're vindicating those rights within is within the prisons. And the reason our work takes us to the prisons is because Native Hawaiians are disproportionately incarcerated. And there's state-sponsored studies on this. There's two studies out there that have concluded that not only are Native Hawaiians incarcerated more often than any other ethnicity in the state, but they are also, when you look at the prison population, they are transferred to mainland private prisons more often than any other racial group.
Why is it that that group is transferred more often? Do they know why?
It's interesting. The study does not explain that. I've heard anecdotal evidence about why that is. There are people who work on prison reform here in Hawaii who have told me that the way it works is the state of Hawaii creates a menu, if you will, of prisoners for the private prison to select. And it is the private prison that makes the ultimate decision about which inmate they're going to take.
Really?
Yes. They make the final decision. They create
at least in a hotel, they've got to take in everybody. That's unbelievable. So they ship these people from Hawaii thousands of miles to the state of Arizona, and a corporation makes a profit off of that. But what happens to the people who get sent to Arizona? How does that affect them in terms of their future once they get out of prison?
There are many issues that I think we're coming to grips with what what happens, what that means, what the impact is.
Yeah.
And one of those issues is, you know, reentry. You know, for those who don't have life to reenter society when you are so far away. What our lawsuit focuses on is very narrow. It's a very narrow piece of what the impact of the transfer is. But we focus on, for the inmates who still adhere to traditional beliefs and practices or who want to reengage in traditional practices, the transfer to Arizona is extremely burdensome on those practices. For one, you don't have access to cultural and religious teachers and spiritual advisors who could provide the kind of guidance and counseling, really the kind of instruction of passing on the tradition to you when you are so far away from home. You know, the other way it impacts, I think, our community is what's happening is right now it's only the men who are being transferred to Arizona. The women were being transferred for a period of time, but there were so many sexual assaults, the state finally brought them back. But at this point, you know, you're talking about taking away from the community the men and who they are and how significant they are in the Hawaiian community. You're breaking part of the cultural transmission, basically, because many of these men are fathers and grandfathers, and yes, they would be in prison still if they were here. But you know, we here for the men we work with, that there is a difference when your family's able to come and see you in prison on the weekends and what that means and how you are still able to either maintain or heal relationships that were broken as a result of whatever circumstances led you into prison. And so for us, we are very concerned about this. You know, in its effect, it's a form of cultural genocide, really.
Sharla, what is the lawsuit asking for in terms of remedy? Are you asking that there be no more transfers to Arizona?
We are at this point talking about, number one, given that the state is going to continue with this policy for the foreseeable future, what can be done within the prisons right now to create a space for Hawaiian practices to occur? And so we're asking that the prison accommodate practices that are analogous to the Native American sweat lodge and practices that they have allowed for other faith groups. For example, it's important to be able to gather and engage in group worship for our clients. The prison insists that, you know, they should be able to pray on their own, except for when, you know, they do allow them to get together. Well, when we investigated this more deeply, we learned that the prisons were allowing inmates of other faiths, for example, the Buddhist faith, to gather Mondays through Fridays every day. And so it just is bewildering why we are engaged in this lawsuit when the practices we're asking the prison to accommodate are things that they are either accommodating now or they have in the past.
We're speaking with Attorney Sharla Manley of the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation, who represents Native Hawaiian inmates. Sharla, it's just extraordinary in two respects that strikes me and Heidi. You know, in New York, prisons are very far away from New York City, and there are prisoners whose families need to get on a bus and travel 6 or 8 hours to go see them. But there's a difference between that and having to go from Hawaii to Arizona. How many prisoners are affected here? What is the proportion of Native Hawaiians to the rest of the population in the state of Hawaii? Can you break that down for us?
Sure. Start with, Hawaii is sending a third of its entire prison population to Arizona. So that's pretty significant in our view. When you look at the statistics on Native Hawaiians, Native Hawaiians constitute 41% of all people who are incarcerated out of state. In comparison, 29% of all persons in the custody of the state are sent to mainland prison. So we're talking about a disparity that both the Hawaii Advisory Committee to the United States Commission on Civil Rights has recognized, as well as the state agency devoted to Native Hawaiian rights. They've recognized, you know, that this is a problem, and they've described this as a significant disparity in how Native Hawaiians are affected by the U.S. criminal justice system.
Yeah, I'll say the other thing that's so upsetting is that there are actually private corporations that make a profit for their shareholders by incarcerating human beings. I wonder what kind of discussion is going on in Hawaii about if you have to put people in prison, and I'm not sure that's a good idea, but apart from, you know, violent people, why put them across the ocean? Why doesn't Hawaii have its own prisons and its own rehabilitation system rather than salting them away, which just increases the odds of their not being able to function in society once they get out? Is there a kind of discussion going on in Hawaii?
There is. It's on its face, that discussion is becoming a deeper one and a more meaningful one. I mean, the governor of our state was elected on a platform of bringing the men home, if that tells you anything.
Yeah, it says a lot.
Yeah, it says a lot. But however, I think what has happened is in the course of trying to make changes to the policy, there is some lack of political will when you come right down to it. I mean, there's some reason this isn't really being done. Now, what is said publicly here is that there's too much community opposition to new prisons being built. I'm not sure that's really the case. But, you know, it is something, this is an issue that on its face is being talked about, and people are becoming more engaged in it. But there is something lacking in terms of the will and the resources that are needed to correct this. You know, to be honest with you, I'm beside myself as to why this hasn't been rectified at this point, or there's not even a plan really for changing this. I mean, shortly after the new governor came into office, the state then renegotiated its contract with the private prison and signed up for another 3 years with some options to renew. Really, it's really frustrating, and it's very confusing.
Charla Manley, I wonder if I might ask you a personal question. How was it that you got involved being an attorney for Native Hawaiian inmates at the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation?
You know, this is an issue that's very, personal for me. I am Native Hawaiian, and I have experienced firsthand, some of what it means to have, the people in your, in your community or in your family be affected by the criminal justice system. For me, I think this is going to be a real reflection on our state, and it's going to be a real testament to whether this is a place that actually walks the talk. I mean, there's a lot of talk in this state about the aloha spirit and what it means to care for one another. And I think the greatest test of whether this is a place that, really believes in those principles and respects the host culture here, it's really a test. Are we going to address the issue of why Native Hawaiians are being disparately impacted by the criminal justice system and why we're allowing a policy to continue? It's a policy of banishment, whereby a majority of the people who are sent away are Native Hawaiians.
Charla Manley, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We want to get back to you as this lawsuit progresses, and we hope we can report to our listeners that you've won this one, and we congratulate you for your good work. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Charla. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Madison, Wisconsin, where a noontime sing-along inside the state capitol building has been going on since March 11, 2011, protesting Governor Scott Walker's union-busting policies. However, a new round of arrests began 2 weeks ago, with more than 100 citations being issued, in addition to the nearly 200 already issued since July of 2012, when the Department of Administration began enforcing new permitting requirements for gatherings in the state facility. What's the Noontime Solidarity Sing-Along all about? We're joined today by journalist and labor lawyer Jonathan Rosenblum, who attends the sing-along protest nearly every day. Jonathan Rosenblum, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's great to be on the air.
You're sitting on a bench outside of the state capitol in Madison, where you've been going regularly to the Solidarity Sing-Along, which is opposed to the policies of the Governor Scott Walker. And my first question to you, Jonathan, is what are the policies that Walker has been carrying out that have incited all these people to get arrested and come every day to the Solidarity Sing-Along? What are you guys protesting?
Michael, when you have a new governor who comes in and within weeks of taking office, described his own legislation, quote-unquote, as a bomb, a topic that he never once during his campaign set out as part of his agenda, which was to end collective bargaining for public sector workers, all public sector workers except those who heartily contributed to his campaign. You have a formula for the kind of explosion that led, I mean, he wanted to explode it. He called it the bomb, and it led to more than 100,000 people multiple times on the square that I am sitting on right now here at Wisconsin Avenue and the Capitol. But beyond the anti-union legislation and agenda, this governor has come in with a pedigree from ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. He, as a legislator in this same building, was a member of ALEC, was a proponent of its agenda in every way. His agenda, as he moved along, moved from eliminating vast numbers of children from Medicaid, of claiming that a jobs agenda would bring Wisconsin to the top in the United States. It's fed plunged to the bottom. And we have a kind of, I mean, this is not an exaggeration to call it an almost colonial-like exploitation of the economy, where the biggest job creator that he's announced is supposed to be an iron mine in the northern part of the state on tribal land that would, by its own wording, eliminate special protections for wetlands and, in fact, create a presumption that wetlands would be destroyed by the mining. So, you know, issue after issue, he eliminated federal funding for high-speed trains, said the trains that were for Wisconsin are now sitting in Oregon. You know, I think that the main point here, though, that should be underlined is that this governor has been about closing the doors of this government to the public. Even the legislation, the union anti-union legislation that led to the crowds, was passed in violation of a Public Meetings Act that the only reason the Supreme Court here in a one-person majority passed it was that the legislature wasn't subject to the open meetings law. So it's okay for them to lock the doors. That's the Wisconsin we live in now. And really, the progressive Republican history of Wisconsin of fighting Bob LaFalle and others is just turning in its grave.
Well, but you guys are keeping that tradition alive by going down to the state capitol. And I should paint a picture for our audience, who many of whom probably have never been. The Madison state capitol looks exactly like the state capitol in Washington, D.C. It's just a tiny bit shorter, but it's a magnificent right. building in the middle of a huge public square. And right. here the Solidarity Singers are going over there every day. They're gathering outside, and they're even going inside. And what are you guys doing there? Give me a feel for what it's like to do this.
Let me take you to March 11th, 2011, when it all started. I was standing there with my friend Steve Burns, who was one of the board members of the Wisconsin Network on Peace and Justice. Folks had slept in the Capitol for weeks. The legislation, anti-union legislation, was passed and signed that day, March 11th. And Steve printed up a few copies of a songbook that had the dome of the Capitol opening up with musical notes on the cover of it, and 10 tunes, the classics of the civil rights movement, but several of them modified in the great sort of wobbly tradition with Wisconsin lyrics, especially This Land Is Your Land, which instead of from California to New York Island, sorry to take you guys out of this, but it became from Lake Geneva to Madeline Island, and from the rolling prairies to our lovely dairies. And not to get hokey, but, you know, this sing-along that began March 11, 2011, and has proceeded from that day without skipping a beat every single weekday since that date. So more than 650 consecutive weekday sing-alongs, songbook going from 10 to 52. It has seen a civil community policing chief replaced in the Capitol by Scott Walker with his chief bodyguard, another like almost unbelievable development. But when he replaced Chief Charles Tubbs, who was really a sort of caretaker of the public voice, even when Walker came in, with his bodyguard, a fellow named David Irwin. Irwin became the force of a crackdown on the sing-along. Well, I don't want to jump into the law enforcement part, but you have to understand that I'm sitting here today where another 20 people are going to be arrested for singing. But the sing-along itself is a joyful conglomeration of Occupy-like and with the UW, University of Wisconsin, faculty, union members. It's an amazing, amazing group that ranges in size. In the lowest time for about 20 people, now it's reached 300 to 400 daily, as the crackdown has actually caused a surge of concerned citizens to join us, usually every day inside the state capitol, Fridays outside with a string band. So for the most part, civil rights songs, always We Shall Overcome to start out, and then a range of tunes, some of which have been modified.
My son Eli Smith just came out with an album called The Union Makes Us Strong. And
yep.
Which Side Are You On, for example, Preacher and the Slave, a lot of these songs on Eli's album are the songs that you guys in Madison have rewritten the words to, but use the same tunes. Give me the name of a couple of your favorite tunes, because we want to play them.
I think in some ways my favorite has become We Don't Want Your Millions, Mister. And one of the reasons for that is that one of the great lines, one of the scary lines, but great lines that's been uttered over the course of this 2.5 year resistance to the policies of Governor Scott Walker was the line that he uttered to the editor of the Weekly Beast web publication when there was a prank call by the editor to Walker within a week of the announcement of his anti-union legislation. And Walker thought he was talking to David Koch. And he literally said the words, thanks a million, to David Koch, you know, who has plugged the state with money, who has piped the state with pipelines, who has really created a juggernaut of a right wing. And alas, Wisconsin is one of its victims. So We Don't Want Your Millions, Mister, is a good one. Among the others, you know, there is power in a union. We have had, there's deep resonance of the civil rights movement here and of union songs. And one of the visitors that we had here was Billy Bragg. And I'll tell you, you know, we also had Arlo Guthrie, Holly Near, and others. But Billy Bragg's the one guy who came up with his guitar, hugged everybody, looked folks in the eye, sang with us, not as a song leader, but as a participant. And it's a lovely tune, but on top of everything else, Billy is sort of a living kind of mouthpiece and singer of the great songs and of the traditions. And that night in Madison, when he gave his concert, he sincerely spoke to a huge crowd about the importance of song as expression of your heart, of your soul, of your activism. And that's what you see here. It's just amazing. I mean, the people who come out every day or just find a way to come out once a week on their lunch hour. So it's at noon, so it does take a little bit of additional resolve. But some folks will come for 10 minutes or 15 minutes because they don't have an hour. But they may even drive here and simply have the joy of 15 minutes with us. But it builds not only a little bit of resolve in people, a moment of tunefulness, but the rotunda itself has become in some ways a wheel of activism so that people spin off from the sing-along and go and work on issues and fight the fight. So that's part of what happens here with that song, too.
Tell us a bit about the police presence, the Capitol Police. Are there many of them? Do they seem reluctant to issue these citations?
There's clearly a split in the Capitol Police by almost personality. And, you know, I mean, they are a relatively down-to-earth crowd, and it's in their average day's work before the sing-along. They were keepers of a, you know, almost like a park service police for the most part. They were keepers of a public space. And what's happened is that they were delivered a permit policy that has once already been declared unconstitutional by a judge. And they were told essentially to crack down and start enforcing it. And they literally delivered tickets, citations to people's homes, workplaces, and then began the handcuffing just in the last few weeks as things have accelerated. But there are officers who have become friends of members of the sing-along over the course of the 2 years, and I think that as the cuffs go on, there's sometimes an exchange of eye contact that they understand that this is crazy, and our folks are sometimes, you know, yelling shame at them, but often just it's singing and expressing to some degree even a kind of sorrow that they are in their own jobs in this position. Now, some of them seem to take some degree of zeal in pushing folks around. There have been episodes of individuals who are disabled on crutches, pushed hard, and regrettable things have happened. There's lawyers looking into some of those episodes. But on the whole, it's a force that has been pushed into even the use of technology as its tool rather than engage community policing, which is what it had been up until about December of 2011 or a few months thereafter. So a long-range acoustic device is now being used. I'm just writing about that with a friend for Labor Notes. The police have started to use a recording of Chief Irwin's declaration of unlawful assembly to blast into the rotunda so nobody misses it. They use the siren that is ramp upable to 150 decibels to disable people. They haven't put it at that decibel level yet, but the state capitol police they're in a bind. I mean, they have their orders. Most of them are executing them with a little bit more zeal than they should. Some of them seem to still be maintaining friendships that they had before with singers. But on the whole, if you underline this, these folks who are the state capitol police are union members themselves who were not included in the special sort of exception that Governor Walker created for law enforcement to keep their collective bargaining rights. So believe it or not, the same police force that is doing the arrests has filed a lawsuit against the administration demanding full collective bargaining rights as public safety officers. So you have this very peculiar dynamic. There is a Lawyers Guild lawyer representing the state capitol police in a claim against the state for violation of collective bargaining. But whereas there is a group called Cops for Labor in Madison that engages police officers in their off time in protests and singing, and we have several who have been very avid participants in the sing-along. You won't find a Capitol Police officer risking his or her job, or even probably his or her, you know, reputation among their own force by ever showing any direct support.
Jonathan, we can have a discussion another time about whether yes. cops are legitimately union members and their social role they play in the society. I'm not sure
Absolutely.
that I'd be wanting to represent them. But in any case, I wanted to ask you, if people want to learn more about Solidarity Sing-Along, get your songs, go to your website, can you help us there with that information?
Well, there isn't per se a website because the Solidarity Sing-Along is every day a new event, a new formation, but there are lots of places to go otherwise for information. There is a site on Facebook that is simply called Solidarity Sing-Along. You go to that and it's a public site and you get daily updates, not necessarily about the fine points of the legal crackdown, by police and the legal response, but tons of music, great comments from people here locally, and tributes from folks all around the country. So go to Facebook's Solidarity Sing-Along Friended. It's got about 4,500 likes right now, and it's been moving at a very high clip. In terms of other stuff, go to Wisconsin Network on Peace and Justice, download Solidarity Sing-Along Songbook, look for the 52-song version, and sing along. And on YouTube, I got to get this in, Michael, so find the hope some way to get it in. Right now, on PBS's Masterworks site for WNET and the national PBS site, the Solidarity Sing-Along has a tune of the Woody Guthrie, This Land Is Your Land. It is the national version, not the Wisconsin version, but it is about to be played nationally on Labor Day as part of a mashup that they're doing. And right now it's beating Pete Seeger's version in terms of its own likes on that page. And there's
nobody would be happier about that than Pete Seeger himself. That's what he's been preaching all these years.
Very
Jonathan Rosenblum, we want to thank you very much for your leadership in protecting people in Solidarity Sing-Along, for your own singing. And we want to thank you for being on Law & Disorder. And we're going to go out with the song you mentioned, There Is Power in the Union. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery and join in the grand industrial band? Would you from misery and hunger be free, then come do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union brand. Would you have mansions of gold in and live in a shack away in the back? Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and starve here with rags on your back? If you've heard enough about the blood of the lamb, then join in the grand industrial band. If for a change you would have eggs and ham, come on, your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union brand. Sluggers to beat on your head, then don't organize, all unions despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. Come all you workers from every land and join in the grand industrial band. Then we are share of Come on, do your part, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. There is power.